Awesome program, and you are listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Paul Blobaum, advocate and brother of a man with intellectual and developmental disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of March 13th, 2017. A Republican proposal to revamp the nation's healthcare system would fundamentally alter Medicaid, potentially threatening access to community-based services for people with developmental disabilities, according to advocates. The plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, unveiled by leaders of the U.S. House of Representatives earlier this week, calls for new limits on federal Medicaid spending. Rather than provide matching grants to states to cover anyone who meets eligibility requirements, the federal government would impose what's known as a per capita cap, providing a fixed amount of money for each beneficiary based on spending in 2016. That would mark a dramatic shift for the program that has operated as an entitlement since its inception in 1965. And such a change could trigger deep consequences for people with disabilities who rely on Medicaid to access everything from doctors to support services to live in the community, advocates say. It's not yet clear exactly how much money the federal government would provide states for Medicaid under the new plan. However, an estimate from the nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities suggests that a per capita cap would mean $116 billion less in federal funding for Medicaid over 10 years, with states left to make up the difference. People with developmental disabilities could lose home and community-based services and coverage of mental health, personal care, rehabilitative services, prescription drugs, respite care, and other benefits could be slashed. What's more, the proposed legislation also calls for an end to Medicaid expansion, which advocates say has helped people with disabilities, their families, and direct support providers access health care. Disability advocacy groups are rallying their troops to oppose the measure by encouraging families to talk to their state and federal lawmakers about how Medicaid affects people with developmental disabilities on a personal level. Nearly 1,000 people from across the country participated in an emergency call last week to discuss next steps. Meanwhile, House Republicans are planning to move quickly with the legislation and already held two committee hearings on Wednesday. However, there are signs that the health care overhaul may not be a done deal, with Democrats and some Republicans expressing reservations about the proposal. Lori Mickelberg of Aurora, Illinois, is a 49-year-old who needs her Social Security disability benefits now. She qualifies for them because she is dying of cancer and can no longer work. However, government red tape is forcing her and thousands of others like her into a waiting period that is so long that many will not survive long enough to collect. Mickelberg receives her chemotherapy treatments for stage 4 ovarian cancer that has spread to other vital organs. She's too sick to hold a job and says the cancer and the weekly treatments leave her weak. Mickelberg is also suffering financially and now fears she will lose her home instead of leaving it to her family. She said, quote, "It may not be much, but it's mine and it's theirs, and that's all I have to give them," end quote. Because of her disease, Mickelberg says she qualified in February to receive $1,900 a month from the Social Security Administration, but she was told that she had to wait until July at the earliest before she can collect her full payments. She said, quote, "I've been working since I was 14 years old. I'm 49. I've paid into Social Security for 35 years. I won't live to collect it." Her claim is being processed through a program called Compassionate Allowance. Those diagnosed with one of 225 illnesses are on a special list that goes through what is described as a fast approval process, but they still have to wait at least 6 months before getting a check. Renata Iwanica, a resident of Southwest suburban Romeoville, said, quote, "To me, it's just horrifying. It's horrifying what they're doing." Iwanica's brother, Derek, who was 40 years old when he was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and Iwanica says he struggled to care for his family while waiting 9 months for his first compassionate allowance check. He died the next week. Says Iwanica, quote, "It felt like Social Security was waiting for him to die, hoping that he would never get a payment," end quote. According to the Social Security Administration, last year 91 people approved for compassionate allowance benefits died before getting them. They could not provide the average wait time for those who live long enough to receive payment. There were 68,827 people who were approved under that allowance program in calendar year 2016, and despite that approval, they still waited at least 6 months to receive a check. Mickelberg says, quote, "It angers me. I don't understand the mandatory waiting period," end quote. Federal legislation is being introduced to get rid of the waiting period by Congressman Rodney Davis of Illinois. And he says, quote, "It just seems like a backward process, especially when you can get it verified by two independent doctors that you're fighting this illness. I think that the bureaucracy in Washington ought to work much faster," end quote. Mickelberg says she isn't sure she'll see the measure become law. The cancer has now spread to her liver. She says, quote, "If it helps one person, then this was the right thing to do, even if it's not me," end quote. She's hoping by speaking out that Congress sees why it is needed. The legislation appears to have bipartisan support and, if passed, could take effect next year. And finally, advocates are working to block efforts to rescind Obama-era education regulations, a move they say would weaken accountability for students with disabilities. Concerns are stemming from a resolution currently making its way through Congress that would toss out rules guiding implementation of the Every Student Succeeds Act, the nation's primary education law. A bipartisan rewrite of what was previously known as No Child Left Behind, the 2015 legislation granted significant authority to states while retaining accountability requirements for students with disabilities and other subgroups. Though the proposed resolution would do nothing to alter the law itself, eliminating the regulations would leave more latitude to states to interpret what the law means, advocates say. The resolution to nullify the regulations has already passed the U.S. House of Representatives and is poised to come before the Senate any day. President Donald Trump has signaled that he would sign the measure. If the regulations disappear, the implications for students with disabilities are likely to be in the details, advocates say. Advocacy groups, including the National Disability Rights Network, the Autism Society, and the National Down Syndrome Society, have sent action alerts in recent weeks, urging their members to call their senators and ask that they oppose the resolution. If approved, advocates say it would mark the first time that Congress has ever overturned an education regulation superseding a months-long regulatory process during which the Education Department received more than 21,000 comments. Republican lawmakers, however, say the resolution is merely an effort to correct an overreach of the Obama Education Department. And that's the news for this week. are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and joined today by my guest, Paul Blobaum, who is a friend and also the brother of a man with a developmental disability. And Paul is here today to introduce himself and talk a little bit about his experiences and what people who are siblings really need to know, and also what parents can learn from Paul and his experience as well. So welcome to the program, Paul. Well, let's try turning your sound up and then you should be able to talk. How about that?
Okay.
There we are. Now I can hear you.
Thank you again, Vicki. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. It's really an honor to be asked to be on your show.
Oh, trust me, I've been meaning to ask you for a long time, so I'm really glad you could do it on such short notice. So, Paul, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners so they kind of know who you are, and then we'll talk a little bit more about your experiences with your brother and your family and how all that's working for you right now.
Sure, I don't mind talking about myself. So I'm the oldest of four kids. I'm 58 years old, going to be 59 later this year. Can't believe I'm that old. So, you know, middle-aged, reaching that stage of life. And my siblings range down to have a brother that's, a year or 2 years younger than me that lives in Des Moines, Iowa, and he has a family. And my dear sister lives in South St. Paul, Minnesota. And the baby in our family is my dear brother Norman, and he just turned 52 this year, and he is our sibling that has intellectual disability, and he's living in our parents' retirement home in northeastern Champaign County, in the town that we grew up in. He lives in Gifford, and he's the reason why I'm talking to you. I didn't mention my parents. We lost my mother 21 years ago this year. My mom passed away of breast cancer in December of 1996, and my mom and dad were in the pastoral ministry. I'd say that because my dad was a Lutheran pastor, and he really considered that he and my mother were partners in ministry wherever they served. And so they served in Gifford 1967 to 1982 is where I grew up. And then they relocated when Norman was either starting his senior year or just before his senior year of high school. They relocated to near Gibson City, Illinois, in McLean County. And so Norman finished out high school in Leroy, Illinois, and Dad retired in 1995, and they bought a house back in Gifford where we grew up because of all the wonderful community of Gifford. Gifford is a town where my grandmother was born into, and so we have known a lot of people, are distantly related to a lot of the folks in town, and so my folks really were looking forward to that as a retirement home, and Norman was looking forward to be back with his friends. But unfortunately, my mother died, a year after they retired, and then so my experience is really as a sibling that's about 8 years older than Norman, but after my mother died, we really were looking at each other and asked each other's questions. Well, what happens if something happens to Dad?
Mm-hmm.
And what's next? And when they retired, when Norman was in high school, my mother really kind of was in charge of the family finances, and she, Norman and my mother, Norman was trained for custodial work in high school, and so he had the job, part-time job, of cleaning the church at St. John's Anchor, and then he did some cleaning of people's homes, and they volunteered together, And so in a rural community, you kind of, when you have a disability, and Norman wasn't really all that interested in driving, but, and so you kind of depend on your family to, you know, to integrate with the community and to volunteer, you know, and they live right next door to the church, so there were a lot of things going on at the church throughout the week, and Norman was involved in all of that, and my parents were too. And then when they retired to Gifford, Norman had a part-time job at Rademacher Lumber and Hardware. And then he, after my mother died, he started volunteering at Country Health Care and Rehab in Gifford. So we started asking, you know, well, what happens if, you know, something happens to you, Dad? I mean, we were worried, and it was really difficult when our mother passed away. I mean, we just really had, all of us just grieved for a long, long time, and Dad was involved in interim ministry during his retirement, and he did the best he could. But one day, his financial advisor, who is a Thrivent agent, mentioned to him, well, you know, Pastor, I think you should really get involved with the Ark of Illinois, go to their workshops. And so he mentioned that to me once. And if listeners aren't familiar, the Ark of Illinois, it's ARC, is an organization, a statewide organization that has individual members, family members, but also organizations that serve people with developmental disabilities. And
there are lots of folks involved with the ARC who are siblings, just like you. So that, I'm sure, was a great connection for you.
Well, it's turned out to be a great connection for me, but my dad and I went to meetings, and we sort of just sat together and didn't really meet, or they didn't really make too many connections, but we went to a future needs planning workshop that was presented by, you know, the several lawyers, legal firms that have expertise in special needs planning are very supportive of the ARC and provide workshops around the state of Illinois. So Dad and I went to those. And then my dad's health kind of failed, you know, living in Gifford, and then I live here in the Chicago area. I live in the south suburbs of Chicago. I went away to college in 1977, left Gifford then, and I haven't really spent all that much time around Gifford since then. So all the people that I grew up with are, you know, have families and either moved away or are in the community, but I don't really know people like I used to. But, so anyway, I belonged to the ARC probably, let's just say, about 15 years, but only recently in the last 3 or 4 years is really when I made a connection with other siblings, because Nora Fox Handler and some other siblings gave a workshop on the sibling experience, and I showed up, and I made sure I shook their hands afterwards, and found out that, lo and behold, there's an Illinois siblings group called Supporting Illinois Brothers and Sisters. And about that time, I think I learned that there was a Facebook page where other siblings could find information and support. But I really felt really alienated and really unconnected from other siblings besides my own brother and sister. There wasn't really a way to connect, or, you know, growing up and the internet isn't all that new. I mean, isn't all that old. And so it didn't really occur to me that there might be organizations that serve or that are made up of other siblings. So it's been just a whole new world for me, Vicki.
Yeah. So what are some of the things, that you learned by being a part of that group? And what I'm getting at is, you know, what have been your experiences with trying to support your brother as a sibling, and how could your parents maybe have helped that to be better for you?
Well, those are such great questions, and I wish my mom and dad were here to speak for themselves, but and I don't really know what they'd have to say, but you know, the times being what they were, even just 10, 15 years ago, my dad was they were really active in their communities, and we really didn't figure out how the service system in Illinois worked, except we knew there was this terrible long process to maybe get services, and it seemed like there was like just a one model, like if your parents died, then you had to go live in a state facility, state development center, and you know, all of us knew that that's not what we wanted for our brother, and that's certainly not something that Norman would want at all. So I think, though, through talking to other siblings, I really learned that my experience was not that unique, and I'm not alone, and my brother and sister and I are not alone, and I learned that it's okay, or that sometimes we have to bring up the subject and kind of help push our parents to talk about important matters. I mean, who wants to talk about death?
Mm-hmm.
or what happens if you get sick and you can't take care of your family member. You know, I was reading that over 70% of adults with intellectual disabilities live at home with their families. And so that's a lot of folks out there that either live in their own homes or they live with family members, maybe their parents. So it was just gradually over the years of asking questions and my dad and I learning together that we learned that, we really don't have the resources in our family to help Norman have the life he wants. We need to depend on the benefits that he's entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad made a very difficult decision of applying for Medicaid because we knew that was, if something happened, Norman would have no health insurance. My dad had been carrying him on his major medical coverage, and so that's a huge issue for all families is medical insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And so these conversations of what it might replace the Affordable Care Act are very scary for me. I toss and turn a lot worrying about, you know, Medicaid and the caps on Medicaid, some of these proposals is like, well, you know, so the other thing I learned from other siblings is like we have to keep on top of things and advocate on behalf of our siblings because we know them best. The sibling relationship, we have the longest lifetime relationship with our siblings. Our parents tend to not be able to live to be 150 years old. And
though a lot of parents
don't either, but
a lot of parents out there will say, "I just need to live one day longer than my kid with a disability," and that is very difficult to do.
Oh, Vicki, and it's so sad for me to hear that, but I really think that that's the way my dad thought too.
Mm-hmm.
That in his heart that he just wanted to live longer. So, you know, he was just afraid of what might happen and wasn't really, none of us were really happy with the alternatives, but we're just so fortunate that Norman is able to live. When we learned about the different supports that were funded through Medicaid for community living, that was a game changer for us. And so Norman really himself chose to have to stay in his community and to have the Medicaid waiver that would help him do that by funding some support help that enables him to live in his home and get to medical appointments and to have help with cooking.
Mm-hmm. So you've got people. You've got people who live in the community who kind of assist him with those things, but you're still kind of managing, kind of overseeing from afar, correct?
Well, I am, because Norman's not interested, and really the financial aspects are very critical to getting that right. And so I bought a fax machine for his house, and I bought a fax machine for my house, and I help him complete the he signs the timesheets for his support workers, and then I check over them. The state has a payroll agent that we fax or email timesheets to every 2 weeks, and then I manage that budget to make sure that we're not overspending it, and then also his personal finances. Thanks to internet banking, I monitor his accounts to make sure that he still stays qualified for Medicaid. I give reports to the federal government. And then also, I don't know how my dad did it. I really don't, but he left some money in his estate in what's called a supplemental needs trust, or a special needs trust. And, I mean, who would have guessed? So it's really Norman's portion of our inheritance. Instead of him directly taking possession of it, his portion of our inheritance as children went into his trust, and that helps pay the real estate taxes. It helps pay, like, replacing, we had to replace the furnace and air conditioner and water conditioner and
the typical homeowner kinds of stuff, right?
So we are quickly
running out of time, Paul.
Sure.
I just want to have you just say a few words about, you know, for those siblings who are out there and listening to this program, what's one piece of advice that you can offer them before they have to step into the shoes that their parents fill right now?
Well, first of all, you're not alone, and reach out. There's SibNet, sibling support on the internet. There's a sibling support project, siblingsupport.org, founded by Mr. Don Meyer. And there's a SibTeen Facebook group for teenagers. There's another one for 20-somethings. And there's another one called SibNet for everybody. Reach out and ask questions. Get involved in the ARC or other advocacy organizations. Go to workshops. Just be gentle with your parents. They might be too afraid to talk about difficult issues, but show that you're interested. Learn all that you can so that you can provide information at the time that it's needed. And think about what, you know, you got to live your life too. Think about, you know, what future you want to have, and then you can help your sibling have the future they want to have.
That's great advice. Thank you so much for joining me today, Paul Blobaum, advocate and sibling. Thanks very much, Paul.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com, or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week. You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and up next is CU Progressive News.
You are listening to WEFT 90.1 FM Champaign, Illinois. Welcome to CU Progressive News, bringing the many voices of your community. The views and opinions you will hear in the next hour are solely those of the speaker. They do not necessarily represent the views of this station, the board of directors, staff, or anyone affiliated with WEFT or Prairie Air Incorporated. This program is produced in the studio of WEFT.